You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, the stock market has now officially crashed through the 2008 bubble euphoria point. In my opinion, we are officially in a new bubble euphoria. But it's just for rich people. Do you know that half of Americans, the bottom half of Americans, own less than one half of 1% of all the stock in the stock market? The top 1% of Americans own over half of all the stocks. Seriously, just wrap your head around this. Just imagine you've got, you know, there's 100 people along, you know, in a football field, right? From goalpost to goalpost, that's 100 yards. You got 100 people standing there, each one of them, you know, about enough space that they could raise their elbows about a yard apart. Or, let's see. Yeah, the 100 yards, you'd have to have each one a foot apart, wouldn't you? No, 100 yards. Yeah, that's 100 people, 100 yards each person. You know, when you raise your arms to your elbows, you're about 3 feet, because if you stretch your arms out tip to tip of your fingertips, it's about the same as the length from your head to your toes. So, in any case, so you got 100 people standing on a football field. The one guy standing on the 100-yard line, or what would be the equivalent, the one guy standing right there by the end zone, he has half of all the stock in the United States. You know, I don't know how many hundreds of millions or billions of shares there are, but he has half of them. He's the 1%. And the first 50 people standing on that football field, between them all, in their retirements and their IRAs and their 401ks and everything else, they have one half of 1% of all the stock in the United States. From the 0-yard line to the 50-yard line, less than 1% of all the stock. And then you go all the way out to the 99-yard line, and that one last guy, he's got half of it. And just consider that as the stock market has hit new highs. And working people are making basically, you know, new lows. I mean, it's really quite remarkable. 1970 was the peak. It was the year that wages as a percentage of GDP were about 0.54%. Billions of dollars of wages as a percentage of billions of dollars of GDP. That's got to be, you know, much lower than it was in the 40s and 50s. Interesting. Meanwhile, an Iowa Republican, State Representative Ted Gassman, I'm not making this up. Maybe it's pronounced Gassman. I don't know. G-A-S-S-M-A-N. Ted Gassman has introduced legislation that would basically force married couples to stay together. Only a Republican would come up with this, right? In fact, 7 Republicans co-sponsored this. The only exceptions are adultery, physical or sexual abuse, imprisonment, or if one partner is missing for more than a year, or if the couple's lived apart for more than 2 years. Why? Because this guy has a 16-year-old granddaughter, and his son or daughter, who we don't know which one is the parent of his granddaughter, just got a divorce. And so this guy puts into the national public record by reading this, by talking about this on the floor of the Iowa House of Representatives. He says, there's a 16-year-old girl in this whole mix now. He's talking about his granddaughter, who is now has one parent instead of two because her parents just got divorced. He said, there's a 16-year-old girl in this whole mix now. Guess what? What are the possibilities of her being more promiscuous? What are the possibilities of all these other things surrounding her life that a 16-year-old girl with hormones raging can get herself into? First of all, if I was that kid or her parents, I would have some serious problems with Grandpa talking like this on the floor of the and not only that, I'm trying to pass a law saying, well, you know, my son or daughter got divorced, so I'm going to make it illegal. But, in fact, over at the Daily Kos, Kaylee Joy Grav, or Gray, excuse me, great post says, we're all very sorry to hear that Representative Gassman's family is personally responsible for destroying America, but it isn't clear how banning divorce would keep Grassman's granddaughter's raging hormones at bay. But she's no doubt very grateful that her hormones and her practically carved in stone hog bag destiny, are now part of the Iowa House record. Thanks, Grandpa. But then, notes Kaylee Joy Gray, but then we all know when it comes to science, especially lady parts science, Republicans tend to get a little confused. Right. As Betty Bowers, you know, in moments like this, issues of morality, issues of religion and raging hormones and whatnot, Betty Bowers has such great wisdom. BettyBowers.com is her website. She's America's best Christian. And here's a little piece of a video that you can find over at BettyBowers.com that I just thought was worth sharing with you. It's just in memory of or in honor of State Representative Ted Gassman of Iowa.
If you believe being gay is a choice, but only because you chose a church that says so.
Join the party.
If you think the New Testament applies to you and the Old Testament to everyone else.
Join the party.
If you think life is sacred but health is negotiable.
Join the party.
If you think the righteousness of being pro-life shouldn't interfere with the vindictiveness of being pro-death.
Join the party.
If you're for unobtrusive government, but one that goes around telling everyone if they're really married or just dating.
Join the party.
If you mistakenly think the Founding Fathers shared your faith but would never vote for anyone who shared theirs.
Join the party.
If you support the Constitution, but only the parts you've seen on TV.
Join the party.
Yeah, it continues. It goes on and on. And it's marvelous. You know, if you think it's intrusive to regulate a utility, but not intrusive to regulate a uterus, join the party. If you believe in states' rights, unless they try to slip some medical pot, join the party. If you're in favor of smaller budgets, but bigger battleships. Yet this is what Republicans are doing right now. They say, oh, that sequestration, it cut all those programs. You know, it's the state of Georgia just sent out a notice to people on unemployment, extended unemployment benefits, that they're going to have a 10.7% cut in their unemployment benefits because of sequestration. Republicans are fine with that. They want to leave those kind of things in place, but they are preparing and will introduce into the House today or tomorrow, in all probability, legislation that will undo all of the sequestration cuts to the Defense Department while keeping in place all the sequestration cuts to human beings, to you and me, to anybody who's unemployed, to anybody who's down on their luck, to anybody who's disabled, to anybody who had a child born with birth defects, anybody who's had a horrible accident, anybody who's gotten sick and isn't insured, anybody who's unemployed. The Republicans say, screw them. We're going to help out the big defense contractors. They're the ones who write the big campaign checks. Why don't they, they need to change the name of the Republican Party. It sounds too much like Republic. Right? It really needs to be the Corporation Party or the Fat Cat Party.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, Grand Old Party was close enough because, like, old white guys, but, you know, somehow. You got a suggestion? 15 minutes past three. So we opened the program today talking about State Representative Ted Gassman and how he has proposed legislation to force married couples to stay together. And said that the reason why is that his 16-year-old granddaughter's parents just got divorced. Either his son or daughter, one or the other, just left their spouse And so he wants to, you know, he and seven other Republicans think that the solution to this problem is more big government. I'm a little confounded about this. Steve Dace, however, seems to have figured it out. Nationally syndicated conservative talk show host, Steve Dace Show, at Steve Dace Show is the Twitter. His website, Steve Dace, DEACE.com, the website. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. What I don't get is this guy saying that his daughter's hormones are raging and this has something to do with her parents getting divorced. And when I particularly don't understand why Republicans want big government solutions to personal problems like not having relationships work out.
Well, I think that conversation actually has to probably be walked back about six steps. I mean, I think you're originally from Grand Rapids, Michigan. I grew up there. So beyond our Michigan ties, let's see if we can come up with something else we agree on. Do you think it's better off if kids are raised by a married mother and a father?
I've looked at the science, and it doesn't seem to make that much difference. There is a difference in financial outcomes, but actually when you take the racial component out, that difference pretty much vanishes between single parents and married couples. There are more single parents among minorities than there are among not among whites. And
Why would we take out the racial component? Why would we do that?
Because then you're comparing apples to apples. If you want to compare single parent white people to married white people in terms of the outcome of their kids, or single parent African Americans or Latinos compared to multiple parent, pair of parents, African Americans or Latinos, basically there's not much difference. The statistics that have been used to suggest over the years
why that racial component exists is because you see more broken families and less more out of wedlock births in those communities. For example,
the racial component exists because of 400 years of brutal racism and genocide in this country.
All right. Well, now see, I'm a little confused here because you just told me that we can't defend marriage on the grounds that he can't control his 16-year-old hormones, but now you want to tell me that because of something that happened 300 years ago, people aren't responsible for their actions in the here and now. I don't understand that.
No, I've said none of that. What I've said is that this Republican lawmaker and seven of his Republican colleagues think that the solution to people's relationships and marriages not working out is to force them to stay together. And I don't understand how that's supposed to work. Do we put a police officer in front of the house and say, you must sleep in the same bedroom, or you have to stay in the same house? I mean, tell me how this is going to work, Steve. You're in favor of this.
Well, I'm a talk show host, too, and we have a tendency to jump on stories like this to draw the greatest illustration of an overall point we're trying to make. But to me, I think if we can't go back and walk back and agree that that children are better off being raised with a married mother and a father.
I will not agree with that.
The red herrings you might throw out there that might elicit a chuckle, when I have to admit to you, it's a pretty funny story. In the end, we aren't going to be able to really agree then on anything at that particular point. I mean,
if
the optimum situation.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
Mother and a father raise children.
If our starting assumption is that it's better for kids to have a mom and dad than to simply be raised by one parent, in terms of economic outcome or psychological outcome, if your starting assumption is that it's better for them to have two parents, and I believed that for years and years and years until just in the last year or so, I've seen the actual scientific data where they actually said, okay, the reason why it looks this way is because most of the people in poverty in the United States who are disproportionately single-parent people are minorities. And so if you separate out minorities from white people and you look at within the minority group, single parents versus multiple parents, or within the white group, single parents versus multiple parents or two parents, there's virtually no difference in outcome. So
I was born to a single mom. My mom was 14 when she conceived me.
So you seem to have done okay.
So I've got a lot of personal experience with this. I mean, my mom and I literally grew up together. I'm white. I will say that our financial consideration improved dramatically when she married the father that gave me my last name.
That's not uncommon.
I see, this is where, again, where we have a huge debate culturally in our country where you and I are looking at the same data, but beginning from a different premise.
Well, I suspect you're not looking at the data that I'm looking at, because
I would look at your data, and I would conclude that the reason why that racial component exists is because you have a huge breakdown. I mean, this is a scene from the movie Boys in the Hood, hardly a right-wing film. I mean, this is where you have generations of dysfunction, unfortunately, and family.
No, I think you're misunderstanding. What I'm saying is that
cycle, and I think that
no,
is.
No, Steve, I think you're misunderstanding what I said. In the black community, the outcome of kids having two parents versus one parent is not that different either. It's just the average American family in the United States has net wealth of around $5,000. The average mm-hmm. white family in the United States has net wealth of around $86,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's you know, the consequence of white privilege and years of segregation.
You don't think an 80% out of wedlock birth rate has anything to do with that? And we for the last 40 years, Tom, we've used all the programs you guys have wanted us to use to try to erase that.
No,
gap.
We haven't.
It hasn't worked.
No, we haven't.
I mean,
how many more years would you like to do it? Undoing them ever since Lyndon Johnson put them into place.
I mean, it hasn't worked. So maybe that's not the solution to the problem.
Lyndon Johnson cut poverty in this country in half. He created essentially the black middle class by making the kind of segregation that you know the marchers on Selma back, you know, 40, 50 years ago were fighting to stop and getting bloodied over. You know, John Lewis getting beaten on the Pettus Bridge.
But we
have somehow got off this topic. I guess I've already made my point. I'll just leave it at that. I don't know how this would be enforced. I don't know why. You never answer my question, Steve.
Well, no offense, Tom. I think your question's silly. The real argument is the argument about the family that I was trying to have.
Okay. Steve Dace, DEACE.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Thanks, Steve, for being with us today. 27 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. Just don't tell Limbaugh he'll want some. Oh, speaking of Viagra, Steve in Williston, North Dakota, wants to talk about Republicans and Menendez. Menendez is a Democrat. What's up, Steve?
Hey, Tom. I just want to let you know I am a product of a divorce. And after my parents got divorced, I didn't speak to my dad for many years. We've since reconciled, but anyway,
well, I think we can all agree having people married is better than generally speaking than having people go through divorce. But that said,
right, I agree.
When you look at both the psychological outcomes and the economic outcomes, they're not that different. Kids of single parents are typically do as well in life as kids of married couples. Oddly enough, it seems counterintuitive.
When my parents divorced, Tom, I spiraled out of control, and for at least 10 years until I was about 28, I was on drugs. I did crazy stuff.
Well, that's a tough one, and I'm not disagreeing with you that divorce is a tragedy and a painful experience, and it's a trauma. Divorce is a trauma, particularly for the kids. I agree with you. We don't want it to happen. So is the solution, this Republican solution, to say you may not leave your husband or your wife? I mean, would you prefer, if your parents, instead of getting divorced, would you prefer that the police check the house once a day to make sure that they were still sleeping in the same bedroom?
No, I'm just saying.
So what's the solution?
Didn't they leave conditions that you can leave? Like a guy or his wife is gone for a year, they're pretty much divorced. I mean, they didn't say absolutely have to stay married.
No, he said if the couple has been apart for more than 2 years, or if one partner is missing for more than a year, missing has a very specific meaning, as in vanished, not just not there. But if they're not living together for 2 years, but during those 2 years, let's say that the husband is the breadwinner, and he's the one filing income taxes. During those 2 years, the wife has no control over her own economic world. You know, she can't get credit cards in her own name. She can't change her name. She can't file for income tax refunds. He can take You know, that's a total disaster, it seems. Or vice versa for that. Well, if the woman was the breadwinner, the husband would be in a position where if he got a job, he couldn't even file his own income tax return.
Right, but it comes down to it's not a Republican or Democrat. It's just an old man who's worried about his granddaughter. I mean,
well, I think at the end of the day, you're right, and I think he's going about this in a really, really dumb way. But I think what it illustrates is that Republicans love big government when it has to do with female body parts, smokable substances, the behavior of people in their bedrooms. The behavior of people in a bedroom being shown on television or on video, when it has to do with so-called moral issues, Republicans, when it has to do with whether or not children are going to say a prayer in school, when it has to do with whether or not the interests of the oil companies and the Koch brothers in continuing to pollute the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, whether and how that is discussed in our schools. When it comes to, whether or not creationism or science is taught in our schools, Republicans love big government in all those regards, and yet they run around saying that they're party of little government. It doesn't make any sense to me.
That's not true. Republicans don't love being big governments on selective issues. I asked my boy the other day whether or not his teacher talked about God, because we got an Obama pamphlet that he brought home, and I was like, dude, I was in kindergarten once, and I never knew who the president was or ever got pamphlets. And I said, well, does your teacher talk to you about God? And he said, no, she doesn't talk about that. She says that's an issue for home.
Sure. Well, it is, isn't it? Do you really want your kids? What grade is your kid in?
He's a kindergartner.
Okay. And if his teacher was a member of the Church of Satan, do you really want her preaching to him?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Then you don't want religion discussed in schools, do you? Unless it's your religion.
No, I don't care what religion it is, but at least acknowledge that religion is.
Well, if you're going to acknowledge God, you got to acknowledge Satan. I mean, go back and read the book of Job, or Genesis, for that matter. I mean, you know, it's the whole thing started with Satan and the snake saying, "Here, eat this apple," right? So do you want Satan taught to your kindergartner by your public school teacher?
Satan can be taught. Satan can be taught by myself and my wife and the teacher. I mean, she teaches him about everything else.
But what if she thinks Satan's kind of cool?
Well, then, I mean, that's something I would have to
then you got a problem with it. This is why we keep religion out of schools, because we all collectively pay for schools, and some of us believe in a Christian God, some of us believe in a Jewish God or a Hindu God or a Muslim God or multiple gods or no God at all, and we all pay taxes for the schools. And so let's just keep it out of the schools.
But why can't we also eliminate evolution out of schools? I mean, that's not a proven theory, is it?
It is. It is very well proven theory. There is no dispute about evolution, Steve. This whole creationism thing is it's sweet. I mean, it's a nice way to try and convince children, I suppose, that one particular interpretation of their Genesis story, which, by the way, only came out of the 19th century, the 1900s, the 1800s, excuse me, the 19th century. That 6,000-year-old Earth theory is less than 150 years old.
I don't care about how old the Earth is. That isn't relevant to my daily, which I work in the oil field, by the way, and it's beautiful up in here in North Dakota. It is not polluted at all. Tons of oil out here, and it's great for our economy. I mean, we don't feel this sequestered at all, but anyways.
Yeah, I'll bet you that the people who live in Cancer Alley down in Texas, downwind from the refinery where that oil is ending up, don't quite see it as whose air is polluted with all these poisons. Might disagree with you. And I'm just curious, Steve, you got oil coming out of the ground. You can put a drop of oil on your hand and you look at it. How old do you think that oil is? Where'd they come from?
Well, it came from the waste materials in prehistoric times.
Yeah, it's dead fossils. I mean, it's dead animal or plant matter. It's typically plant matter, mostly plant matter. And it's at least 300 million years old. So you don't want...
You're basing on carbon dating, right? You're basing that on carbon dating? How do we know that's accurate? I mean, really.
Okay.
I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying, how do we know that's accurate?
Because there are people, there is an entire profession of people who have dedicated their lives to, they're called geologists, to understanding
right.
how time interacts with planet Earth, and they've kind of figured this out. They've come up with these eons and these eras, and you know the Jurassic and the Thoracic, or what? You know, that's the part of the spine, and the Permian, and the
right.
you know, and on and on and on. I mean, you know, these guys have figured this stuff out. This is not in dispute, Steve.
Right, I agree. We kind of lost track here. Anyway, so why are you talking about this guy from Iowa? But you don't talk about Kent Salazar from New Jersey.
Kent Salazar. You're talking about Robert Menendez.
In a major scandal. Robert Menendez.
Yeah. It turns out that, you know, when Tucker Carlson on his blog, The Daily Caller, published this story that slandered Bob Menendez, who's a good Democratic senator, claiming that he was patronizing a hooker down the Dominican Republic, that either this woman has now gone on the record and said that she was paid to lie, and then there's the FBI went down and did an investigation on this, and it just came back. I don't know if you've read today's paper, but it sure looks like Tucker Carlson and Sean Hannity and all the guys that ran with this, as if it was a news story, that they've been perpetuating a lie. And the question is, who set up this lie and why? Because Menendez is up for re-election in 2 years.
He's been traveling down there. How do we know she isn't paid to lie that she lied?
Well, you know, I suppose it's not inconceivable, but why would it have even gotten into the press? Who leaked this into the press? Tucker Carlson isn't talking.
Well, maybe somebody with interest for him to lose his seat.
I think so. I think this is Republican dirty tricks, just like, you know, when Jack Kennedy was president. And there were Republicans peddling the idea that he was sleeping around. Turns out he was.
I heard about Mimi. Mimi, what's her name? Beardsley.
Yeah, I don't know the names. But the fact of the matter is that it happens. But apparently it didn't happen with Menendez in this case. But you know, again, why? Here's what I don't understand, Steve, is I'm having this conversation with this right-wing talk show host who is saying, we should ban divorce. And somehow this has become a Republican issue. I don't see what's partisan about this. Why would Republicans...
I'm for...
Go ahead.
Not banning divorce, but let's make it as hard as we possibly can.
Why?
Why not do that? What's wrong with that, really?
Well, because when a relationship is dead, I think that it's in the best interests of both the parents and the kids, for the parents to move on and find somebody that they can have a good relationship with and raise their kids in a new loving family. There are a lot of families in America where the parents are on their second family. They're, you know, and they're doing just fine, thank you very much. And making divorce hard or close to impossible would, you know, cause, I think, you know, a lot of misery. Steve, thanks for the call. And thanks for the interesting conversation. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So why do Republicans selectively love big government and then claim that they hate big government? I still have not been able to come up with an answer. Why'd they flip the stars upside down on the GOP logo? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And John in Downingtown, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, you've got an idea for a new name for the grand old party?
Yeah, instead of the GOP, we'd go with the COP, the coin-operated party, because it doesn't work for you unless you put money in it.
Okay.
Yeah, and,
that's a good one.
Yeah, the part that you guys are talking about with the divorce rates and things like that, if the guy really wanted to make a difference, I mean, if financial woes are the primary driver of divorce, wouldn't it make sense to fight for a living wage instead?
Yes. Yes, that's an excellent point. And
also with the
raise the minimum wage.
With the disparity between African Americans and whites also, I'm sure it has a lot to do with the fact that the majority of African Americans live in cities where they're more likely to rent than to own, and that
a big driver of wealth as well.
Well, and increasingly our jobs are leaving the cities because we don't manufacture things anymore, and manufacturing has typically been a city thing, whereas agriculture has typically been a rural thing. So excellent points, John. Thanks a lot for the call. Appreciate it. Karen in Garner, North Carolina. Hey, Karen, you have a name for the GOP?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great.
Yes, I do. I've got a couple. Excuse me. Greedy opposers of the people.
Ooh, interesting.
Greedy ornery politicians.
Uh-huh.
And the greedy oligarch party.
The greedy oligarch party. Wow, I like that. Those are some good ones. And you wanted to make a point about divorce?
Oh, yeah. I think the best thing my alcoholic husband did for me and my daughter was leave us, mm-hmm. because all we would do is fight.
Yeah. And that's the point. I mean, I think that when the time comes that a relationship is over, that having the ability to divorce, these are decisions that should not be made by the government. These are decisions that should be made by families, you know, with extended family or with pastoral counseling or with a psychologist or just by themselves. This is not a decision that should be made in Washington, D.C. or in a state capital, in my opinion. Karen, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing that point of view. Greedy old politicians. Greedy ornery politicians. GOP. Rick in Renton, Washington. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, Tom, I know you're familiar with Neil Walsh.
Yeah, I know Neil.
Yeah. Well, in Conversations with God, Book 2, he had suggestions on how to make this a better world, and I read it back in the 90s, and I remember three of these points. One was that everyone should have food, have access to food.
Right.
One is the another one, everyone should have access for housing, to housing. And the third one is you tax people that earn over $20 million a year, 100%. And this was back in the 90s. You could make it $50 million a year.
Sure.
So,
well, and this is basically what FDR was doing. I mean, he was taxing people over... And back in those days, in today's dollars, it would be the equivalent of maybe $1 million, $1.5 million a year, was at 91%. And he proposed, in the year before he died, a second Bill of Rights, which included food as a right, housing as a right, and a job as a right, and health care as a right. And FDR's second Bill of Rights was a big deal, and we should have been taking it seriously rather than going backwards. But the Republicans have been fighting this stuff ever since, and they are hell-bent for leather right now to repeal the New Deal. Rick, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Sophia in Maysville, Kentucky. Hey, Sophia, you have a suggestion for the Republicans?
Hi, Tom. I think since the Republicans are so desperate to rebrand the Democratic Party, the Democrat Party, I think we should rebrand the Republican Party the Plutocrat Party.
Indeed. Also, well, that's what they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And given the plutocrats' track record regarding women these days, I'll bet the Iowa, wasn't it? Legislator?
Yeah.
I bet his divorced child was a daughter or is a daughter. I can't quite see a plutocrat forcing a son to stay married.
Oh, that's an interesting point, too, because of the sexism inherent in plutocracies. Very interesting. Sophia, thank you for calling and thank you for pointing that out. Fascinating. Tiffany in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Tiffany.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. I hope you are, too.
I am, and I'm an African-American female,
mm-hmm.
and I don't believe that poverty is tied to African-American poverty in any shape, form, or fashion. I believe everything you say in terms of it's 400 years of oppression, which continues on.
That was my point. That was my point, that racism is still alive and well in the United States, and that if somebody is born white in America, the odds are, and they have multi-generational American parents, odds are that through the generations, that family has built up not only economic capital, but also social capital and intellectual capital.
Absolutely.
Whereas if somebody is born African American in this country, odds are that it's been just in the last few generations that their family has had the ability to build up any of those three kinds of capital, because just three, four generations ago, their families could literally be torn apart by being sold. They were not allowed to learn how to read or write, and they were not allowed to own anything. And in fact, arguably just two generations ago, that latter category, you know, couldn't find employment and couldn't have access to wealth. And when Scalia says,
happening.
Yeah, it's of course it's still happening.
And in terms of just divorce in itself, I think it would be cruel and unusual to force people to stay married. I mean, Women's Lib came along and it blessed women to get out of horrible marriages.
Yes.
Where they would be abused.
Yes.
And to perpetuate that, it's insanity.
Yeah. Well, I thought the earlier caller who pointed out that it's a safe bet that State Representative Ted Gassman, who is talking about his granddaughter being the child of divorce, I almost certainly is she is the daughter of his daughter, because if it was his son, he would be
completely different.
Yeah, it would be a different perspective. Tiffany, thank you for the call, and thanks for your thoughtful comments. I appreciate it. 15 seconds. Okay, real quick one. Jared, New York City, you got a quick call for the quick name for the GOP?
Rich Folks Party.
Yeah, the Rich Folks Party. The RFP. Let's change it from GOP to RFP. I'm with you. That's a good one. Thank you, Jared. And thanks for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in New York City. We're going to pick up the next hour. We're going to talk with Randall Ray. He's a professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City and senior scholar at the Levy Economic Institute, the author of Modern Money Theory. Talked about that on the program here. We're going to do another workshop, another seminar, another online training program on modern money theory. Stick around. The guy who founded it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the second hour of our program. And as promised, Dr. L. Randall Ray is with us. He is a professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute, the author of Modern Money Theory, the blog neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Ray, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
I'm so happy to have you with us. Could you give us, I want to really dig into modern monetary theory or money theory here. First of all, is there, I've heard it referred to both as money theory and monetary theory. Are they two different things, or is this just two ways of referring to the same thing?
I think it's two different ways of referring to the same thing, with some of us using monetary and some of us using money.
Okay.
I think I probably tend to use money more often.
Sure. Well, if it's the title of your book, I would certainly, I would definitely do that if I were you. For our listeners who are not economists, can you give us a 2-3 minute kind of snapshot summary of what is modern money theory? What is modern about it? What is, different in as much as it's a new theory as opposed to old theories?
Yeah. Well, if I wanted to state it as simply as I possibly could, I would say that those of us who follow this argue that a sovereign government is actually nothing like a household. So all of these analogies that, oh, I couldn't run my household the way that the federal government is running its budget, it's just not applicable. Sovereign governments are very different. Now, how did we get this name, modern money or monetary? I think that it all goes back to John Maynard Keynes in his Treatise on Money, which was his famous book before The General Theory, the one that most people know about. And he just said, look, the kind of monetary system I am describing applies to all monetary systems for the past 4,000 years at least. And so I just sort of took that. Okay, we don't know what happened before that. Maybe the story of Robinson Crusoe and Friday, and they were bartering fish for coconuts, and it was very inconvenient, so they decided to use seashells, and gradually over time it evolved to a gold commodity money. Maybe that applies somewhere, to some universe, to some distant time, very distant time. It does not apply to any monetary economy for the past 4,000 years. This is what Keynes was saying. And so
you're saying the story of where money came from is even
worse. Right. That's right. The story of where money came from really is not applicable to any monetary system that is modern in Keynes' sense the past 4,000 years. Now, I don't even need to make that case, of course. I think that Keynes was completely right, and in my own books I have looked at all the evidence that we have, going back to Mesopotamia, for example, and I'll tell you what, authorities played a role all the way back. It sure looks like the monetary system was not invented by Robinson Crusoe and Friday. Instead, it was invented by the authorities. In the beginning, the temple authorities, the palace authorities, and then we, evolved the king and finally democratic government. All the way back, always some form of state authority has always been involved in creating, supporting, protecting, managing our monetary system.
Would it? And the reason for this is so they can take a piece of the action, right?
Well, yes. I mean,
could I give you a thumbnail characterization and you tell me if this makes sense?
Sure.
Whether it was a kingdom or a theocracy or a tribe or whatever it may be, the community as a whole, and whether it was small d democratic or not, the community as a whole had certain things in common. There is a commons of some sort, and that commons had to be supported by all the people who were members of the community. So they had to figure out a way that when people were interacting with each other in ways that could be called economic, that a little bit of that action could be skimmed off the top to pay for the commons, and thus was born money. Does that make sense?
Yes, my shorthand way of stating it is that the monetary system was created and developed and evolved to move resources to the public purpose. Now, it's pretty hard to say that, you know, the crown operated in the public purpose, but clearly that is what we have evolved to in democratic states. It's to serve the public purpose. Right. That, from inception, that is why we have a monetary system. Now, the monetary system also serves the private interest, too, of course. And there's no reason why we have to say it must be one or it must be the other one or that they must always be in conflict. Of course, there's a great area of overlap between the public purpose and the private purpose and what we need the public purpose to accomplish so that the private purpose can accomplish what it wants to accomplish.
So money is really kind of it's a social construct. And ever since 1971, we have had nothing backstopping our money except the value and wealth of our society. So is that an accurate statement?
Yeah, in fact, I would say ever since Mesopotamia, so for 4,000
years,
that has been true. Now, people get all confused about the gold standard.
Right.
You have to remember the gold standard was very short-lived. I'm talking about a 4,000-year period. Gold standard, there's a debate about, you know, exactly what qualifies for gold standard, how long it lasts. And the arguments run from anything like, well, it lasted for at most 2 decades, to it lasted perhaps sort of for a couple hundred years. That is it. That is the whole extent.
Well, didn't the Romans use, though, precious metals for their coins? At least silver.
See, but that's a different matter. Precious metal coins, think of them this way. These are IOUs that happen to be stamped on metal rather than stamped on pieces of paper or today electronic entries on balance
sheets. And so they would use a precious metal because they don't oxidize as easily. Is that?
There were probably a number of reasons for using precious metals. One is that their value can never decline all the way to zero. Even if the crown defaults on his IOUs, the value of a precious metal coin is not going to go below the bullion value, or very much below.
Sure.
There's a little bit of a hassle in melting it down and assaying it. But if you go back to Roman law, so you're right that they issued IOUs stamped on gold coins, but in Roman law, coin's value was determined by the nominal value, not by the embodied gold. And this is the typical case. The coins circulate much above their embodied precious metal contents value.
So we've never really had a precious metal standard, even the Romans.
Yes.
It's just never happened. It's a myth. And so how, we have just a minute before we got to take about a 30-second break here. But so how do you respond to people who say, since the 70s, the value of the dollar has collapsed? It's all because we went off the gold standard.
Well, it hasn't collapsed. Have we had inflation? Yes, we have. On the gold standard, the typical case was that we would have inflation in good times and deflation in bad times. So people will say, well, over the course of the 19th century, when the gold standard was strongest, we had no inflation. But that is going from measuring prices in 1800, measuring them again in 1900, and you find out that the price level is about the same. But meanwhile, over the course of that century, they had huge inflations and huge deflations.
Mm.
Now, we know that in modern capitalist economies, deflations are absolutely devastating.
Right. Deflations, also known as Great Depressions.
That's right. And so, yes, we have cut out the deflations so that the only trend is up.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting. We're talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, author of Modern Money Theory. The blog website is neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be back with more Dr. Ray in just a moment, 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out the blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Dr. L. Randall Ray, W-R-A-Y, professor of economics, University of Missouri in Kansas City, senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, one of the founders of Modern Money Theory, and the author of the book Modern Money Theory, the blog neweconomicperspectives.org. First of all, do I have all that right, sir?
Yes, you
okay.
do.
Just always good to reality check that. So one of the tenets of Modern Money Theory is, and you started the program with this, the idea that running a government the way that you would run a household is stupid, that a sovereign nation can do things households can't. I even find the household analogy, the way it's used, to be stupid, because you've got people running around going, oh, my God, our debt is equal to our annual income. And I'm thinking, most people who have bought a house have a debt in that house, have a mortgage that's equal to two or three or four or five times their annual income, and they don't think that that's weird. They think that that's an investment in the future. So why should we even be concerned with our national debt until it gets to be where, you know, a mortgage would become problematic? But you say even that is, or I'm guessing you would say even that is a misdone analogy.
Yeah, I would say that looking at the government debt ratio is a complete waste of time. It doesn't provide you any useful information at all. Investments in the future, that's the way you want to look at this. Is our government investing enough in our nation's future? And I don't think there's anyone in the United States that would say yes. Mm-hmm. So we need to be investing more.
So
I think that the debt ratio just gives you the wrong answer. Look at the reality. We have bridges falling down. That's the reality.
Right. And in South Korea, every home has a T1 line coming into it because the government built a national broadband fiber optic infrastructure, or the government helped fund it. Same thing in Europe, high-speed rail. China's building out their infrastructure, and businesses are going, hey, this is cool. High-speed rail, high-speed internet, inexpensive telephone service. I think we'll build a factory here, and not to mention cheap labor. But so instead, we're right in the middle now. Republicans are getting ready to introduce into the House legislation that would undo the sequester for military spending, which seems to me, reality test this for me, building things that you drop on other people and they vanish does not seem as productive as, you know, there's bombs and weaponry.
Right.
Does not seem as productive a use of money as building things that are the substrate on which business happens, and, you know, schools, hospitals, roads, bridges, highways, broadband systems, power systems, et cetera. It seems like you can't even make a dollar-for-dollar comparison.
Yes, and of course, if we had had this attitude on the eve of World War II and said, well, oh, you know what, we can't afford the war. Can you imagine that? So in the case where we actually needed the defense spending, we just did it. We did it. We ran budget deficits at 25% of GDP. No problem at all, and we came out of the war a much stronger nation with much more rapid economic growth, rapidly rising living standards, and all of that was, you know, supposedly with this huge debt burden coming out of World War II, where the debt to GDP ratio was 100%. I don't want to make a big deal about the debt ratio because I think it is completely misleading. You're focusing on the wrong thing. But it was 100% then. It's 60% now. And right now we're hysterical about the size of it. It's crazy.
Yeah. So what should we be hysterical about? If we're to be concerned about our economy, what part of our economy should we be looking at and saying, oops?
Well, number one is unemployment. That's clear. We have 25 million people who would like a full-time job and can't get it. Some of those are part-time employed, but that could be as little as 1 hour a week. Some of them are officially unemployed, and some of them have just given up all hope of ever getting a job. This is devastating. The impact from this will last not until the recovery, not until a robust economy, but for a generation. We're in danger of losing a generation. People who are long-term unemployed become unemployable, at least in the view of our private sector employers. It has a devastating impact on the economy.
Yeah, and this in particular seems to be hitting people in their 50s now. People, that cohort seems to be the most unreemployable, 50s and early 60s. Although you also have the Gen Xers, the people in their 30s and 40s, and then the millennials in their 20s, the 20 somethings who can't find a job.
Well, college graduates.
Yeah, new college graduates.
Time.
So
yes.
What's the solution? Government becoming the employer of last resort?
Well, of course I support that. So the employer of last resort is a permanent program. So we should not look at that as, you know, a solution for high unemployment that results when you're in a deep recession. So we should have an employer of last resort or job guarantee program in place always. It acts as a buffer stock. It's good for the private sector. It's good for the people who fall between the cracks and so on. In addition to that, so that's a permanent program. In addition, it's obvious we need the federal government to spend more. We need a payroll tax holiday. We should reinstitute that, but it should be a 100% holiday, not a partial holiday.
Wow. So why do you think that this deficit hysteria is going on?
I think it is largely politically driven by those who absolutely hate what conservatives call entitlements and the rest of us call a social safety net. We take care of our own. They hate that stuff.
Right. You're right. And therefore the cost of that stuff, they're saying is too much. But even when Bill Clinton had budget surpluses and George Bush in his first inaugural address said that he was going to pay off all of the national debt that could be paid off, he still wanted to privatize Social Security.
Well, again, Wall Street doesn't like the competition. Medicare and Social Security, the most important government programs the United States has ever had, they hate the competition.
Yeah, and the competition is in the private sector. We're talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray. I want to get back to how you respond to people who say, but wait a minute, if the government becomes the spender of last resort and we run up a bigger budget deficit, that's going to cause inflation. I want to hear your response to that right after the news here at the bottom of the hour. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We're talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray, one of the founders of Modern Money Theory, the author of the book Modern Money Theory, the website neweconomicperspectives.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and we are talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray, W-R-A-Y. He is a professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, the author of the book Modern Money Theory, and blogs at neweconomicperspectives, plural, .org, And Dr. Ray, welcome back.
Hi.
So, to the question, you're suggesting that that what we should be focusing on as a country is not how in debt we are or anything like that, but rather whether or not we are building for the future, whether we're building a nation that works and that will sustain itself through the future, if I'm paraphrasing correctly so far?
Yep.
Okay. And that even if we have to do significant deficit spending in order to accomplish that goal, that should be done. And a piece of doing that should be bringing the nation to full employment. You with me so far?
Yeah.
Okay. So how do you respond to the people who say, okay, what you're talking about doing, and I'm guessing most of these people don't recall the history of Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower doing this exact same thing, but in any case, what you're suggesting doing, basically, quote, printing money, end quote, or creating money, and or borrowing money, actually, given the current way things are done, borrowing money and then spending it would put the nation deeper in debt, number one, burden our children, you know, with hundreds of thousands of dollars of future debt. Every child born is born with a $30,000 debt. And number three, devalue, debase, and or inflate away the value of our currency. How do you respond to that?
Okay. Look at it this way. Really, at its basis, what modern money theory says is that we can afford to buy whatever is for sale in dollars. That's what we're saying. If you see unemployed labor out there, Uncle Sam can afford to put that labor to work. If you see...
No matter how much there is.
Yeah, no matter how much unemployment there is. And as long as what Uncle Sam does is he only puts the unemployed labor to work. He only puts the underutilized plant and equipment to work. The underutilized, I don't know, paving machines to work. This is not going to cause inflation.
So it becomes problematic when the government starts competing with the private sector. But as long as the government is filling in the holes left by capitalism or left by the private sector, it doesn't affect monetary policy. Or it doesn't have a monetary outcome.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have a price outcome.
Price outcome,
and,
okay.
And here's the thing. When there are unemployed resources out there, the government is not competing with the private sector. The private sector has already said, you know, we don't want to employ those things. And the second thing is the government can keep the price down on that stuff. It doesn't have to bid it up. It's bidding against itself. Mm-hmm. So there's no reason why the government would be raising the price of any of that stuff. Because there's no alternative. Either the government hires it or it's unhired.
Okay. And then it seems logical. I mean, looking at the experience of Truman and Eisenhower, who borrowed massively to build highways and schools and hospitals and put America back together and thus massively expanded the tax base, the employment base, the GI Bill, for example. And those people paid taxes, and that paid down that national debt. Would not the outcome of what you're proposing, even though over the short term it would increase the national debt, and even though you don't think the national debt is a big deal, wouldn't it over the long term have the same outcome as it did after World War II of paying down the national debt? And would that be a good thing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, what happened after World War II is, of course, we had a baby boom. We had 3.7 kids per family. We had to prepare for that. We prepared for it by putting in place the public infrastructure that we would need. A lot of that's still there. It's starting to crumble. You know, it's been a long time. It's been two generations now that we've had any attempt by the federal government to do something like that. And now what do we face? We face an aging society. We've got an aging boom instead of a baby boom. We need to prepare for that. We need to start getting ready right now in order to take care of our retiring seniors. And what are we doing instead? We're laying people off. We're, you know, shutting down local government. We're saying we can't afford it anymore. We're doing exactly the wrong thing.
How does modern money theory approach Hamilton's 11-point plan for manufacturers, mercantilism, the Tudor plan, the idea that right now, if a dollar is spent by the federal government to stimulate the economy, you know, we put somebody to work building a bridge, that money only stays in the American economy for basically a cycle and a half or two cycles. As soon as it hits Walmart, it ends up in China.
Yeah. Well, I know that this, many people are scared about this. We're in hock to the Chinese and so on, but you have to step back and take the bigger picture view of this. We have a number of countries around the world that want to accumulate U.S. dollar financial assets. You know, in a way, these are votes of confidence in the U.S. dollar. So we've got our nutty people running around here saying Uncle Ben is sparking hyperinflation, and the rest of the world saying, hey, we want a piece of the United States. Right. They're voting exactly the opposite way. And as long as these countries want to export to us in order to accumulate financial assets, we're getting the better part of that deal. Now, I know that the objection is that, but hold it a second, we've lost jobs to Chinese.
Well, no, so we've lost manufacturing infrastructure. We've lost the intellectual equity associated with it. People don't know how to make, you know, anything from hard drives to steel tool, you know, to tool and die, you know, super 1/10000th of a micron, you know, all that stuff is gone. That they do that in Germany now, not here, or Italy.
But if the government played a leadership role, we would be putting those people back to work, and we could be the technology leaders. We could be the green tech leaders, not the Chinese.
So you're suggesting we don't need a mercantilist trade economy? Because, I mean, this is what the Chinese, the Taiwanese, the Germans, they have all, everybody's kind of bought into the NAFTA, WTO thing and dropped tariffs, but they're all using VAT taxes as reverse tariffs. They'll double the VAT tax on the import of goods, and they'll eliminate the VAT tax on the export of goods, which makes it, you know, and we're doing none of that. We not only don't have tariffs, we don't have VAT taxes either. So we're not able to protect our exports and protect our domestic industries. Is there not a role for government to play in doing that? Or is that completely outside the realm of money theory in any case? And it's another argument altogether.
Yeah, I think here we are getting into sort of development strategies
mm-hmm.
that modern money theory by itself probably doesn't add much, except to say that anything for sale Uncle Sam can afford. And if we wanted Uncle Sam to play a leadership role, Uncle Sam has the money to play that role. The Chinese government is playing a leadership role in China, and you can see the success of that. We choose not to do it because we think we're broke. So what modern money theory says is that's crazy.
Right. And we chose to do it back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and we built the largest industrial economy that the world had ever seen.
That's
right. And how is it, and much of that was done under Republican administrations, how is it that modern, I don't want to make this hyper-partisan, but how is it that the people of that political party can look back at that history and not learn from it and not say, you know, gee, that worked out really well for Eisenhower. Maybe we should try that again.
Well, I think that there is a great ignorance of how we did that. But I think that a lot of this just, it's boiled down to some fairly crazy politics and this idea that, America has provided too strong of a social safety net, and that is making people lazy, and we need to get rid of the safety net. I mean, this goes against, I think, just about everything we know. If we look at Europe, they had a stronger safety net, especially in the north, and these countries have done much better than we have done in the past 30 years.
Well, this is Sir Francis Galt. I mean, this is Darwin's cousin, the British economist in the 19th century who was decrying the British social safety net, saying that Darwin's theory of natural selection should be applied to economics and we should do away with all social safety net programs to force people up from the bottom. Is that, are we not seeing a modern version of that right now?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not sure they even really believe it. If you go back to Reagan, you remember trickle down, and
sure.
The argument was stuff trickled. No, cream rises to the top. So actually, when you remove government from the economy, you remove social protections, what happens is that everything rises to the top. You develop a two-class society where the upper class, we're talking about the top couple tenths of 1%, and then the rest of us. So that's what actually happens when you do that stuff.
And we're seeing this in the wealth distribution now in the United States. Just the stock market, for example, stock market just hit an all-time high. 50% of all the stock held in the United States is held by the top 1%. The bottom 50% of Americans in aggregate own less than one half of 1% of all the stock. This is the consequence of conventional economics, it seems. How are we different since 1971? Are we playing by a completely different set of rules or just a slightly different set of rules?
Well, very different. We have pretty much destroyed labor unions, and that is a big piece of the puzzle.
Well, I was thinking of 71 being when the gold window closed. That's that's not the big one. Let's continue. We'll continue this conversation right after this. We're talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and neweconomicperspectives.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
That blog is neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be right back. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're talking with Dr. L. Randall Ray, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, senior scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, author of Modern Money Theory, the book, blogging at neweconomicperspectives.org. And his last name is spelled W-R-A-Y for those of you furiously Googling. And Dr. Ray, I mentioned 1971, and I was talking, of course, of Nixon taking us off the gold standard, but you said that was when we really, you know, unions started to collapse. I think the peak of that, you know, hyper-aggressive effort to destroy the unions was probably 81 when Reagan went after PATCO and declared war on organized labor, and for the first time in the history of the U.S. Department of Labor, put a person in charge of the Department of Labor who was hostile to labor. Why is the destruction of unions in the United States more important than our having gone off the gold standard?
Well, I think going off the gold standard was a good thing. Attacking labor unions has not been. Labor unions played a really important role in raising living standards, also raising the productivity of workers. Because if you raise wages, firms actually have an incentive to try to increase productivity. So the rising living standards in the post-war period, up through 1974, actually, had a lot to do with the stronger power of labor, which really required the union movement, so that in negotiations they at least had some power. You know, otherwise, capitalism really, it's pretty much an unfair game, because the worker has to work to survive, and the employer has the option of, you know, shutting down business for a while.
Right. So how do you respond to those who suggest that unions are producing artificial scarcity by locking out non-union workers? At least this would be pre-Taft-Hartley, and or in the not right to work for less states. And that one of the things actually that destroyed unions was that they couldn't maintain that scarcity anymore, that there was a scarcity of labor after World War II because we needed all that productive capacity. But then not only did we no longer need it so much, but also women started coming into the workforce in a big way with the women's lib movement and whatnot, and in the 70s and late 60s through the 80s. And that diluted the labor force enough that unions couldn't hold on to that power. Does that theory make any sense? I've had several conservatives promoted on this program, and I don't have a good rebuttal for it.
Well, there is a bit of a dog and bone story here. If you have 10 dogs and you bury 9 bones and you send them out, you know one dog's going to come back empty-mouthed. And it doesn't matter how much training you give them, how much motivation, you know, give all the speeches you want, tell the dog to do a better job. If he comes back the next time with the bone, it just means another dog doesn't have one. So you pit the dogs against each other. And because after 1974, we grew much more slowly than we had before that period, there were fewer jobs out there, fewer bones. And And so you could pit, you know, union worker against union worker, but more importantly, union worker against non-union worker. And then you get the much more general support for so-called right to work laws, because it seems like it is the union's fault that you can't get a job, when in reality, it is because we're not creating enough jobs.
Right. The nature of the economy is changing. So would the appropriate response to that have been for the government in the 70s, when our productive capacity outstripped our demand for labor? Would that, at that, is that the point at which government should have stepped in as the employer of last resort to keep, to maintain low unemployment and keep employers competing with each other for labor?
Yes. We reacted the wrong way to what I think everyone concedes was an oil price shock. So we had oil prices quadrupled in 74. And so we decided to react by slowing down our economy rather than let's try to become more oil efficient, which is what the Japanese did. And we did the same thing under President Carter the next time we had an oil price shock in 79. Again, let's slow down the economy. We brought in Volcker. We got 21% interest rates overnight and so on. And then the recession, and then we got Reagan busting labor unions as if they were the cause of high inflation. Well, it was very clear what it was. It was oil, and it was food prices, which tend to be related to oil, but there were special things going on at the same time with regard to, you know, food becoming globalized. So rather than attacking the problem directly, which is oil prices and food prices, and to some extent shelter prices, the component of home that is in the CPI, we decided to, you know, bust labor instead. That was the problem.
And we've been doing it ever since. We've been doing it for 32 years, basically, since the Reagan presidency, have we not?
We've tried race to the bottom dynamics, yes. Rather than, trying to create good jobs and so on, and building up our infrastructure, becoming more productive, better educated, and so on, what we've done is try to hold wages constant, which we actually have absolutely done.
Right.
The average worker's real wage today is where it was, actually probably a little bit below now because of the recession, where it was in 1974. So this is unprecedented in American history, where you go through a couple of generations and more with absolutely no wage growth whatsoever. And that is because we want to be the low-cost producer around the world. We can't. There is no way we're going to be the low-cost producer around the world, no matter how much we attack labor and hold wages constant.
Right, because there's always going to be poorer, more desperate countries that are willing to bid against our labor.
That's right.
Which brings us back to mercantilist policies, but let's not go down that road. We just have 30 seconds. Your thoughts on austerity?
It's the worst possible response to our current predicament. You couldn't imagine a worse policy response to slowing down the economy even more. The government has become a jobs killer, not in the conservative sense of the term, by regulating private firms. No, by actually taking jobs out of the economy by laying off government workers.
Right. We've laid off 700,000 government workers in the last 4 years, and it looks like we're fixing to lay off another 600,000 or 700,000 with sequestration. It's remarkable. Dr. L. Randall Ray, the professor of economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City, and author of Modern Money Theory, blog neweconomicperspectives.org. Sir, thanks so much for being with us today.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. It's news reports are indicating that Hugo Chavez, the well-known president of Venezuela. Louise and I were actually in the country when we staged a coup against, not Louise and I, but the United States, helped fund a coup against Chavez. He was gone for a couple of days. He came back. Anyhow, it's been reported that he has died. It's not confirmed officially by the government of Venezuela, so We don't have official confirmation of this, but it seems to be the case. So we've covered a lot of territory today on the program, from deficit hysteria, inflation, austerity, unions, 1971, the gold standard, all this modern money theory stuff in the last hour with Dr. Ray. In the hour before that, why is it that conservatives love big government when it has to do with regulating people in the bedroom or in the in their living room or in their gardens? But they hate big government when it comes to regulating billionaires polluting our air or banksters ripping us off. What's the deal? I don't think that these are really conservatives. I don't think they're really Republicans in the tradition of the Republican Party. I think they're corporatists, and they are scallywags. they are ripping people off intentionally. So, but anyhow, that's just my thoughts on that. So, oh, and Paul Krugman says he wasn't prepared to debate Joe Scarborough. That's ouch, ouch. Paul's a good guy. So, anyhow, 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty, thanks for calling. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Hey, Tom. Hey, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, earlier we were kind of discussing about, the consequences of, moving some of these manufacturing jobs overseas. And I just wanted to kind of bring up a point on cybersecurity, because one of the problems that we're going to face is, since a lot of our networking technology is now manufactured overseas, a lot of exploits can be built into what we import in our networking infrastructure that will allow, during a cyber war, for, people that want to exploit it to basically open up loopholes that were intentionally put there, in order to compromise our, our basic core infrastructure for communication.
Yeah, this is one of those kind of Tom Clancy scenarios where the Chinese government decides that, who owns many of the manufacturing companies in that country, decides that, when Dell starts manufacturing parts of their computers there, that they're going to build into the programmable read-only memories, the PROMs, and other, other programmable, essentially hardware parts of their devices, back trap doors that will enable, with just the right ping, with just the right IP address from just the right type or what, I'm way out of my league here in talking about this, but you know what I'm talking about, that those back doors can be opened, and then those computers are being used to run the power plants in the United States, and those computers are being used to run the sewage systems in the United States, and they're being used to run our electric grids, and they're being used to run our banks and our businesses. And if we ever really, really get in a war, as it were, not even necessarily a hot war, but just a struggle with China, for example, over Taiwan, they just open those back doors and just shut down our country. Is that what you're suggesting?
Oh, absolutely. And it's very real. Like, I was reading a blog on this guy that was basically doing some work on a Siemens controller or whatever and was able to basically crack it in hours. I mean, we're up against some really intelligent people out there that if at a moment's notice could really shut down a lot of our core infrastructure because we depend so much on that technology to run, our day-to-day operations.
Yeah. And need not, I use the example of China. If a country where the manufacturing is done intentionally puts back doors in, that's one way it could happen. It need not be that nefarious, though. I mean, it may be that China's never done anything like that. It might just be that, the nature of the Internet and the nature of computer hardware and software is such that, and, going all the way back to, DOS 3.01 or 1.3 whatever it was back in the days, or CPM for that matter, or MS-DOS, we can be hacked. Cyber wars could happen regardless of where the computers are made, and it could be any one of dozens of countries or even a non-state actor. It could be Al-Qaeda that takes down our power systems.
Yeah, that's also very likely. I mean, I know because I work in information technology, and I heard a story that this one wind power plant was basically outsourcing, some of the controller hardware, and then when they got it back, they noticed some codes, or it wasn't responding to these short codes to like turn it on or off, and it was actually part of it was rewritten in different codes. So there, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a made-up scenario. I mean, there are, that kind of stuff is going on right now as we speak.
Yeah. And well, and look at what we did there. The United States and Israel got together and put together the Stuxnet, or Stuxnet, or however you say it, virus or worm. And it infiltrated the Iranian, the PCs that are running the Iranian centrifuges and caused them to run backwards and sideways and basically kind of blow themselves up or eat themselves, ruin themselves. And excellent point. Marty, thank you for the call. I'm going to put you on hold here because Shano tells me that you are the recipient. You are the winner. Marty's on line four, by the way, Danielle. You are the winner of an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, my book about using neurolinguistic programming, NLP, in political dialogue, how to have political dialogue. So Marty is our book winner for the day, and a copy of that book is going to go out courtesy of stamps.com to Marty. Thank you for that. Ricardo in Chicago, you wanted to get back to divorce?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I had a comment on the talking point earlier about the whole institution of marriage. I disagree with what they're putting forward, where people should be forced to stand together, or any sort of relation with that. Now, the only thing that I would agree with is some sort of like penalty. I just feel like people have lost the fundamentals of what a marriage institution actually is. You know, you got people going to Vegas or just any one of these states that will just marry them and the next day they'll divorce. I mean, it just demeans us as a society. That's just basically what I wanted to share.
Well, divorce is a contract, essentially, and there's the familial contract, the social contract, and then there's also an economic contract, and the economic contract is backed up by tens of thousands of state, federal, and local laws that confer certain advantages, in some cases even disadvantages, but typically advantages to people when they get married. And divorce is the dissolution of that contract. So I think, you know, at a certain level, contract law, as it were, requires that there's a certain difficulty associated with divorce. But if we're trying to do social engineering, it seems like spooky territory to be walking into. Ricardo, thanks for the call. We'll see where that goes. Jane in Santa Cruz, California, you had a new name for the GOP?
Yeah. I've always been enjoying thinking of them as, not that I'm happy about this, as the greedy old patriot. I'm sorry, the greedy old patriarchs.
Greedy old patriarchs. That's
GOP, greedy old patriarchs.
Yeah, that's good description. Mitt Romney said on TV.
They're nothing if not greedy, and they're nothing if not patriarchal.
And most of them are old white guys.
That happens to be true.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
And then I had another quick comment about the divorce issue. I know I sound young, but I'm actually retired and born in 1946. And I used to be a family therapist, and I heard thousands of sad family stories. And I can tell you that quite a lot of women need to get divorced to get away from stalking husbands.
Yeah, makes perfect sense that divorce is a women's issue. And that allowing easy divorce is something that women need. It absolutely makes perfect sense. Jane, thank you for sharing that. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Modern money theory. How could we have got it so wrong for so long? Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Chris in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Chris, you had a MMT, modern money theory question.
Well, yes, I was thinking, well, why can't we take back the money power as suggested in H.R. 2990 by Dennis Kucinich, where we incorporate the Federal Reserve into the Treasury Department. And we issue greenbacks with the monetary authority, suggested in the Chicago plan. Anyway, he would spend money on education, health care, and infrastructure to keep us from going into deflation, and the banks would have to have 100% reserves. No fractional reserves, No more bank panics. What do you think?
I think it makes a certain amount of sense, although I'm not a professor of economics. It's a good question to raise with Randall Ray or Stephanie Kelton or one of these modern money people the next time we have them on the program. I'm trying to get them on, you know, once a week for the next little bit here until we all, you know, you and I have kind of a shared mental database about how this stuff works, and also trying to get these out to more and more of our politicians. Certainly the Ron Paul, let's go back to the gold standard, has infected a large number of Republicans. There are no, to the best of my knowledge, no members of Congress who are adherents of modern money theory. But it makes a certain amount of sense to me, Chris, what you're suggesting. I think privatizing the Fed, the way around the Fed, of course, is to simply have the Treasury Department still has the ability to print its own money. It just has to do it as coins. You know, what we have, because the Constitution says explicitly in Article 1, Section 8, that one of the powers of Congress is to authorize the U.S. Mint to issue coins and to determine their value. The conclusion that we have come to since 1913 with the creation of the Fed is that if you have paper money, it says on a Federal Reserve note, it is from the Federal Reserve Bank. If you have coinage, that actually is produced by the United States Treasury, by the United States Mint, and that is actually U.S. government money that is brought into being by the U.S. government. And so the modern solution that some of the MMT people have been talking about is just have the Treasury Department, you know, to kind of work around the Fed or get the Fed out of the way, have the Treasury Department mint, you know, 5 or 10 $1 trillion coins, put those coins, and they would have a $1 trillion value because, excuse me, the Constitution gives the federal government the authority to determine the value of the coins and to coin them. And then if they deposited those coins with the Fed, that would, you know, wipe out the debt, you know, just pay down our debt by depositing them with the Fed against our account. And then, of course, with regard to the banking laws, fractional banking, that's a matter of legislative changes, you know, changing how we do our banking. So I don't think that we have to absolutely nationalize the Fed, but it does seem to me like a really good common sense thing to do. And this is the debate that goes back to the original Hamilton Jefferson debates and Andrew Jackson, you know, that he campaigned on and whatnot. But I think that paying down the debt by issuing a coin or a series of coins and then putting them on the deposit is another way of doing that. And it would make everybody crazy. Not everybody. It would make all the right-wingers crazy. People who just don't understand that, hey, you know, the U.S. government issues dollars. And they say, well, what about inflation? Well, what about the $30 trillion that the Fed created out of thin air in 2008 during the financial crisis in order to loan to banks? You know, it's $30 trillion. No inflation came out of that. So, yeah, I'm with you, Chris, and I would do that. Thanks a lot for the call. James in Sunderland, Mass. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? So I was listening to you and Professor Ray talk, and I didn't hear you talk about about who owns the U.S. debt. Okay, so
he would say it doesn't matter.
He would say it doesn't matter, but it doesn't matter, and this is why. Because about a quarter of it is owned between departments of the government.
Right.
And then beyond that, half of the remaining amount is, or more than half of it, rather, is owned by private investors in the U.S., domestic investors, businesses,
right,
private citizens, whatever. When you talk about China, China doesn't own the U.S. by any stretch of the imagination. They own maybe 7% of our debt. It's about $1.2 trillion.
Right.
Okay. So,
and you could argue that, I mean, you could call that China owning our debt, or you could simply say China has invested in treasury bills. You know?
Absolutely. And the thing is that, you know, it doesn't get paid out all at once either. You know, we pay interest each year, and when the bond matures, we pay back the original value of the bond. But
right,
the interest rates are so low now that it's, you know, it's kind of not really a problem. Just for that reason, I mean, more than 66% of our national debt is owned domestically by U.S. Institutions, the government, the private individuals, businesses, et cetera. et cetera. It's really not. It's all political grandstanding.
Yeah.
In other words,
I totally agree with you, James. And thanks for listening to WHMP. Totally agree. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Got a minute to the break, Steve. What's up?
Yeah, I just think that the two political parties are kind of like a deer in a headlight. When they look out and see that every single problem they're talking about has an infinite number of solutions. And, you know, they can all...
I don't hear anybody from either party saying that. I think the problem is that both parties are suggesting that there's a very, very small number of possible solutions.
Yeah, but that's not, backed up by simple logic and reason.
No, it's not. But you've got the Republicans running around saying the solution to everything is cut, 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 austerity, austerity, austerity. And you got the Democrats saying, well, maybe the solution is just not to cut so badly. And, seems crazy to me.
Say, take everybody's money and give it to me.
I've never heard a Democrat say that. I've heard right-wing talk show hosts say that Democrats say that, but I've never heard a Democrat say that. Have you? Can you identify a Democrat who's ever said that, Steve?
Oh, certainly, yeah. Who? Just here recently on a local issue.
Who?
Uh-huh?
Who said that? Who said take everybody's money?
Well, it's not a question of taking everybody's money. It's just that when you start totaling it all up, in other words, we need to have an alternative maximum tax.
Okay. Steve, thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
As I suspected, there are no Democrats saying take everybody's money. We'll be back. 27 minutes, best. It's the good, the bad, the very, very mesophilously ugly, the good. Rolling Jubilee. The offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement has raised enough money to pay off over $11 million in crushing personal debt for countless Americans. Although household debt declined in 2012, it still totaled at $12.9 trillion and has exploded since 1980 in the dawn of Reaganomics. Private debt is a dead weight on economic recovery and needs to be fought if we want to restore the prosperity of the middle class. Any amount of help by the folks at Rolling Jubilee is a good start. Working Americans, not banksters, need a bailout, and it's encouraging to see Rolling Jubilee tackling this head-on. Keep up the good work, Occupy. The bad. The DEA. Trying to continue a war they already lost, 8 ex-DEA czars urged the Justice Department on Tuesday to take action and block Washington and Colorado before their foolish war on drugs goes up in smoke. As one former DEA chief, Peter Bensinger, said, "My fear is that the Justice Department will do what they are doing now, do nothing and say nothing. If they don't act now, these laws will be fully implemented in a matter of months." Right, because all those former DEA chiefs did one heck of a job overseeing Richard Nixon's failed drug war over the last 40-plus years. It's simple. Legalizing marijuana is just common sense now. Anyone who thinks otherwise, anyone who thinks we should keep pouring billions into a racist drug war that only benefits private prison contractors is... well, smoking something bad. And now the very, very ugly House Republicans. Talk about tilting at windmills. On Monday, House Republicans proposed a bill banning funding to ACORN, a community organizing and voter registration group that does not exist anymore. It was slayed by right-wing media lies in 2009. But, just to be sure, House Republicans are defunding it again. I guess some myths are just too good to kill. Public has caught on to the right's voter suppression campaign, so now Republicans need to recycle old racist demons to push their anti-democratic agenda. This isn't just cynical politics or bad storytelling. It's very, very ugly. It's incredibly ugly. Okay, the Venezuelan government is confirming that Hugo Chavez is dead at the age of 58. May he rest in peace. And it's going to be interesting to see where the country goes from here. David in Pacific, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, David, what's up?
Oh, thank you, Tom, for the referral to 91.3. It's a fantastic radio station.
Great.
Well, I called because you were talking about the GOP earlier, and I like to refer to it as a greedy old people party, because corporations are people, too. which leads me to the RNC, really nasty corporations. And thank you for the conversation with Dr. Ray on modern money. Maybe we should refer to time as more valuable, seeing as we only have about, 99 years before global harming strikes us.
Yeah, and well, and we all have a lifespan that's limited to, you know, roughly 80 years on average, 70. I think the average American lifespan now is in the mid-70s, actually. And so we should be thinking of time as a commodity of some value and respecting the life that we have here day to day. And tragically, we're not. So many of us are not, or we get so, you know, wrapped up in other things. David, thank you for the call. It's lest I wander off into areas of philosophy and theosophy and whatnot. Eric in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Eric, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Eric. Hope the same is true of you.
Yeah, me too. Well, it's great talking to you. I love your show. I just wanted to talk about the divorce bill a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I don't know if anybody referred back to the Declaration of Independence when they thought up this bill, but it really doesn't bode too well with life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness to people to stay together.
To force people to not get divorced, to prevent people from getting divorced.
Right.
Yeah, it seems to me like this is patriarchy on steroids. This is because usually in bad relationships, if there is an economic or a physical victim, it's usually women. And
absolutely.
Yeah, and what this would do is limit their ability to get out of these relationships in a way that is a clean break, both economically and legally. And
in a sense, it boils down to false imprisonment.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point. Eric, thanks for listening there in Knoxville, Tennessee. Susan in Chicago. Hey, Susan, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Yeah, I actually wanted to share one of the best explanations I've heard of modern monetary theory. My apologies if Randall Ray made this analogy already. I didn't catch his whole interview. But I credit this to Professor James Galbraith at the University of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And his analogy to modern monetary theory was like printing more money, putting more money in circulation is like putting more bowling pins in a bowling alley that we just keep knocking over the pins and entertaining ourselves with it. But it doesn't really do any damage to put more pins in circulation. And so the analogy to personal finance is flawed, as if like the country has to balance its budgets the way individuals do. And the evidence is that Japan is still borrowing money at very low rates, and they're actually taking steps to put money into their economy.
Right, and they're over 200% of GDP, the debt-to-GDP ratio, and have been for decades. And they just keep rolling it over.
There's evidence that we won't be able to borrow money at as lower rates with more bowling pins in circulation.
Yeah. There you go. That's an interesting one. Although, Susan, the it's been a long time since I was bowling. It's 10 pins, right? There's 10 pins in a lane.
Right, but if you just put more out there, more people bowl. It's like more people spending money, and it's not.
Right, but I mean, what if?
I heard the explanation. I kind of got it. Maybe not. I'm doing justice.
Yeah, you're saying the number of pins available in the entire alley, but they're still always just putting 10 in the lane. What happens if they started putting 15 or 20 in the lane? It starts dynamically changing the nature of the game, arguably for better or for worse, but it's going to change the nature of the game. And that's where that metaphor seems to break down. But if you were to say you're just increasing the number of pins that are available. So
you'd say that the bowling alley is under capacity, that if all the lanes weren't filled, and right now the bowling alley is not.
Oh, okay. So in other words, you've got a bowling alley with 10 lanes. You only have enough pins for 5 lanes. So let's bring in enough pins for 12 lanes, and now all 10 lanes can run.
Right. And it doesn't have to just be consumers bowling. You know, government spends money, too, and it certainly should be government spending money.
Right. Okay. That's a good one. We got to get Jamie Galbraith on the program. That's next on my hit list here. Susan, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for sharing that. Beth in Austin, Texas. Hey, Beth, what's up?
Hey there. Well, a prior caller kind of stole my thunder just a bit, but my suggestion for the Republican Party name is corporations really are people too. And of course, that does have an interesting acronym associated with it.
COPT.
corporations really are people too.
Okay, I got it.
and you know, I know you know this because I've listened to you for years. But when you talk about, you know, your confusion over why Republicans are interested in what's going on in other people's bedrooms, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing about the Republican platform, distilled down to its essence, it's only beneficial to people at the very top layer of our society.
Sure.
And there's just not enough people to ever win in an election if you just put those groups, you know, if you just limited it to that group of people.
Mm-hmm.
So much like the Nazis early in the party's years, opened their arms to the church. And in the same way, the Republicans need a certain religiosity to bring other people in so that they have enough people to sort of, you know, not make it equal with the Democrats, but, I mean, they still have to do dirty tricks and stuff and try to prevent people from voting. But, I mean, they would never be a party if their platform was solely limited to policies that help corporations, you know, like unions are bad and stuff like that.
Well, I think those have always been their policies. What they do is, and they do a very good job of it, is basically lying about their policies. You know, the Violence Against Women Act, for example. Michelle Bachmann yesterday, it was on the Think Progress blog, she voted against the Violence Against Women Act, the expanded version. She voted in favor of the Republican version, which excluded gay women, lesbians, excluded women on Native American reservations, who right now are the victims of a legal loophole that allows non-reservation residents, largely, you know, local white people, to come onto the reservation, rape Native American women, leave the reservation. Reservation police can't leave the reservation to arrest them. Police who are not reservation police can't go on the reservation, you know, can't prosecute somebody who committed a crime on the reservation. And so what this law would have done is it would have prevented those women. And one in three Native American women has been the victim of a sexual assault at some point in her life. So, you know, Michelle Bachmann voted against those groups, but her spokesperson came out and said, oh, no, she voted in favor of it. So they're just like inventing reality. They don't say, oh, yeah, we're just in favor of the corporations and to hell with the average person or with women on Native American reservations or whatever. They just invent these alternative realities. Beth, thank you for the call and for giving me the opportunity to rant about Michelle Bachmann.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Always a worthwhile thing to do. Earlier, we gave away a copy of Cracking the Code, my book on NLP and politics, courtesy of Stamps.com. Welcome back, fair and only, slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. Speaking of which, Mike in Fairfax, Virginia, you want to tell me I'm wrong? You've got Democrats who did say they want to take away all your money?
Not all of it, but a lot of it.
Well, come on. There's a huge difference between all and a lot.
Let me give you an example. So Jim McDermott calls in this moron, Teresa Guilducci, from the Center for Social Reform and Justice, or whatever the hell it is, and she wants to basically punitively tax 401ks that people saved and worked for to put them into some general fund called the GRA where everybody gets an equal dole. Isn't that theft?
401ks are already punitively taxed. They're taxed by the banksters. Did you realize that by the time people start burning down their 401ks, typically they've paid over $100,000 throughout their lifetime in fees?
Sure.
This is something that, you know, this is a brainchild of the Reagan administration. Let's get people out of pensions. And let's get and out of Social Security and into things that are that the government, you know, the bankster run, government protected, ring fenced things called 401ks. They started with IRAs, actually, and then the SEP IRAs, and then they went to 401ks. And in each one of those stages during the Reagan administration, they came up with these newer and fancier ways to move people away from Social Security and toward private savings. They made it harder and harder for you to get your money out of those things if you ever needed it, increased the penalties, and made it harder and harder for you to prevent the banksters from basically robbing you blind during the time that you have to have a bankster administering it for you. It's one of the reasons why I don't have a 401k, because I owned a business when this stuff was going on, and I looked at it and I said, I don't want to do this to my employees. I don't want it because I don't want to do it to myself.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
I've done like 15% rate of return over the last decade. How's your 401k doing?
I don't have one. And congratulations on you, Mike. I mean, you know, that's great that you can invest like that. If 50% of Americans own less than 0.5% of all the stock in the United States, this is a discussion that for half of Americans is completely irrelevant.
So let me give you another Democrat that wants to steal money. The idiot councilwoman in Detroit. 50 years of failed Democratic policies. The state's bankrupt. They voted for Obama, and now they want to tax the other 49 states, reach in my pocket, take money to bail them out from 50 years of failed policies.
Mike, I would strongly advise you to look up the rate of – there's a word for it that's escaping me right now, but states take in federal dollars and they pay out federal dollars. And what you will find is that the blue states, by and large, for every dollar that they send to the federal government – they get back 60 cents, 70 cents, 80 cents, less than a dollar. California, New York, all the blue states. They get virtually all the blue states. They get back less than they send to the federal government. The welfare states, the red states, Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas, West Virginia, Florida. The red states are the states that are taking back from the federal government more than they're putting into it. If those states,
when was the last Republican
if era? Those states. Right. If those Republican states were run, if we as a federal government treated those states the same way that the European Central Bank treats individual European states, then right now Mississippi and Alabama and Texas, the other red states, would have a serious – they'd be Greece. They'd be complete basket cases. So you want to talk about, taking money out of the pockets of the other states. The red states have been taking the money out of the pockets of the blue states for the better part of 70 years.
This is where progressives fail to understand libertarians or any kind of conservatives. It's not right when red states do it. It's not right when blue states do it. It's not right when either state does it. And you guys think we, like, carry the water for those states. They shouldn't be on the dole either. They should be self-sufficient. If that means they got to raise taxes or change their fiscal policy or cut back on programs, then they should do
well,
that.
Well, you're assuming, Mike, right that these states are operated as independent nations, and they're not. And that's why nobody's having this conversation.
Most of the states you mentioned have balanced budget amendments.
Every state in the union except Vermont has a balanced budget requirement in its constitution.
And so if they can't balance their budget internally and they're dependent on the federal dole, then they've lost all sovereignty, just like Detroit has, and they're probably going to have an emergency manager. Failed fiscal policy.
Not true. First of all, states constantly run deficits, even though they have balanced budgets requirements in their constitution. A great example is California under Schwarzenegger, or for that matter, California under Reagan. They simply borrow the money and they put the bonds on their balance sheet. And, we'll pay this back at some point in the future. And,
another quick comment about the $1 trillion coin. If you guys print that, be the downfall. If you mint the coin for $1 trillion because Obama tells you it's worth $1 trillion and you put it in a vault and try and pay off debt with it,
right,
you will see the biggest flight from the United States dollar into the yen, gold, and every other commodity on the planet.
And you know this because you got your PhD in economics from where?
I got an MBA from Maryland. I don't have a PhD from anywhere. Okay. But I'll tell you this, working in the economy, you will see the big dollars can move globally in a blink of an eye. Yeah. I can buy yen 100 times a second.
Mike, if minting currency, if minting $1 trillion is going to cause everybody to flee the United States, then why didn't they do it in October and November of 2008 when the U.S. Fed created $29 trillion out of thin air?
So all I'm saying is...
No, wait a second. Simple question. The Fed created $29 trillion, almost twice our GDP, out of thin air and loaned it to banksters, not just here in the United States but all over the world. Why didn't the dollar crash?
I'll tell you one other Democrat who stole.
Why didn't the dollar crash?
FDR.
Why didn't the dollar crash, Mike? When the Fed did that?
When what? They put the money.
When they, you said if Obama, and he's not going to do it, but if you said if Obama were to create $1 trillion in the form of a $1 trillion coin. That everybody would flee the dollar. I'm asking why, when the Fed in 2008, at the end of the Bush administration, created almost $30 trillion, why didn't the dollar collapse?
I'll give you a great example.
No, please answer my question.
No, here's an example. here's the answer. If you looked across Europe and everywhere else, the whole global economy was seizing up. We are the center of banking on the entire planet.
Okay, so you're saying that Obama should create a trillion-dollar coin because when the Fed did it, it worked out just fine, right? Okay, I guess he's gone. Coming up tomorrow, this month marks 10 years since our nation was lied into a war by the Bush administration, and still no one has been charged with war crimes. We'll talk with one of the key players, Doug Feith, who was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under George W. Bush from 2001 to 2005. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.